Hey, this is Kyone Wolf. I'm here with Betsy Kaplan in your podcast feed saying thanks for tuning in, first of all, and please keep this podcast going by calling 1-800-584-2788 or by going to WNPR.org/donate. That's the place where you become a member or you renew your membership. And most importantly, you keep us going.
And we can't do this without you. Kyone and I, along with the rest of our team, put on the Colin McEnroe Show every day of the week for you because we love to do this for you and we love the show as well. So give us a call, 1-800-584-2788, or go online at WNPR.org.
Enjoy the show.
Darko Trejnik is an unusual man. He has been the creative director, the artistic director of Hartford Stage for a number of years now. He's departing to do other things. This is a conversation which we had a few days ago. He talks a lot about what it means to run a theater company, also his own peculiar vision of theater, what theater means in society, and talks, I think, in a very unusually personal way about what moves him. I've known Darko a little bit in all the years that he's been working here in Hartford, and I'm comfortable saying that I've never heard him talk like this before. So I hope you do stay with us and meet, maybe for the first time, maybe anew, Darko Trejnik. It seems kind of sad to call this an exit interview, and he's not exiting quite yet, and we don't know which side of the stage he's exiting on either. But Darko Trejnik is here, the outgoing, in several different senses, artistic director of the Hartford Stage Company, and we are probably having our last conversation on the air, at least while he holds this title. I should say by way of context that just because of the way things worked, we needed to pre-record this interview. We're actually pre-recording it at the exact moment that President Trump is ending the shutdown of the government. And that'll be interesting because I think at some point in this conversation, we're going to talk about what it's been like to be an artistic director in 2016, 2017, 2018, and so forth. But first of all, welcome back to our studios.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah, well, we are happy to have you here. So I guess maybe before we talk about the past, talk about the future. What's going to happen once you finally close the door at Hartford Stage?
Well, for Hartford Stage, we just announced the wonderful new artistic director, Melia Bensusan, and I couldn't be happier. I think it's a fantastic choice. I think she's going to be absolutely great. I truly, truly adore her, and I'm getting to know her right now and ensuring a smooth succession and ensuring that she's beautifully set up at the stage and in the community. So she's absolutely fantastic. And for me, you know, there are artistic directors who direct and directors who are artistic directors. And I'm definitely, you know, in my heart, I'm pretty much a director who artistic directed at two institutions. But ultimately, the artist lately is winning out. So I find that in the next phase of my life, all I want to do is really direct. And it's been a great, great time at Hartford Stage. It's been the best. I've had such a wonderful time with our staff, our board, the whole community. It has been such an honor, but I'm just a little bit, I can't keep up. I'm getting older. I can't keep up and you know, Anastasia is playing in New York, national tour, Spain, Germany. It's opening up in Mexico City and in Holland at The Hague.
So just to put that in context for people. So Anastasia, which debuted here at Hartford Stage and then moved on to Broadway. You're responsible not only for the New York company, but for all these other world companies?
Well, there's a wonderful team of assistants. You know, and I have a European assistant who's fantastic. But it is my production, and I do have to be involved. So just the schedule, you know, the schedule started to get kind of overwhelming. And I wanted to stay at Hartford Stage as long as I could do an absolutely great job and give it all my energy. And I think change is good for me as an artist, and it's really good for arts institutions. I think change is a good thing. So I can't wait to see what Melia brings.
You know, I want to go back to something that you said because I think I understand what you mean by it, but I'm not sure the average person or maybe even the average theater goer fully understands.
Or anybody who's not inside of my head.
Or anybody who's not inside your head. Okay. So you said, you know, there are ultimately you've decided you're a director who has been an artistic director as opposed to an artistic director who also directs. So there's I think we have a vague sense of what a director of a play does. But maybe we don't understand what the artistic director does that is so different.
Well, you know, with Mike Stotz, who's leaving for Paper Mill Playhouse, who has been our managing director and with a wonderful company, you know, you pick a season, six plays every season in addition to the Christmas Carol. You have to make sure that the programming is exciting, eclectic. You know, you have to make sure that it also, that certain number of the shows bring in audiences, because that is just the financial reality in a country where we don't get a lot of government support for the arts. So it's a very, very complicated equation. And in addition to that, what I'm proudest of about Hartford Stage and Mike Stotz, it's very much due to his efforts, is that we have an education department that reaches 21,000 students across the state of Connecticut, which is the most extraordinary statistic about the company, you know. So it's a huge, huge job. And I'm also, you know, as I said, I wanted to give it my all. But a few years ago, my mom died, and I started thinking, you know, I didn't skip a beat. I was in tech the next day.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's the thing worth mentioning. You were in tech the next day in a different part of the country, right?
Your mother died. I had to fly to California, you know, because we were doing a co-production of Kiss Me, Kate, and I was really close to my mom, and I wondered how I was going to deal with it. And I gave 67 notes that night. Mm-hmm. You know, I fired them off one after the other, and I was like, I'm where she wants me to be. But in the long run, you know, if you don't take time, it costs you as a human being. So I just need to a little bit. I just need to take it easy.
Yeah. I could have told you that. I kept working after the death of each of my parents, and I didn't take enough time, and I paid a price.
One does. And I'm just starting to realize that.
So. Well, this whole adventure started in 2011, but the first thing that happened was your dog died, right?
Yeah. The first full day at Hartford Stage, you know, I didn't even make it to say goodbye. And 2 hours later, I had to give a speech. There were huge expectations about a new artistic director, and I didn't skip a beat, and I felt like a monster. Your heart can grieve, and
Compartmentalizing is the word for this, right?
I find it really hard to say that word. It's one of the few words my Yugoslav tongue just gets. I have to think about it syllable by syllable.
It's not a particularly
thank you
good
for saying it.
It's not a good word anyway.
No, it's not a good word. It's not a nice sound.
Yeah. I mean, we should be, it's about not being real, not being in the moment. It's about doing something else.
And
it's probably not a healthy thing for us. Well, there's so many things I want to talk to you about artistically, but I think, partly because you came into the studio kind of mumbling a Cole Porter lyric to yourself, that I want to start with musicals. I mean, you won a Tony for A Gentleman's Guide. You did do a Kiss Me, Kate, memorably a production of Kiss Me, Kate here. Obviously, the musical means something to you. First of all, maybe just say a little bit about that. You and I talked about this, I think, at the time of Kiss Me, Kate, but you grew up in a different country, kind of digging American musicals.
I did. Every once in a while on Yugoslav TV, they allowed an MGM musical to come on, and it was heaven. And, you know, because I've directed so many operas, and by now so many musicals, about half of my life is working with musicians, either on revivals or new pieces. And right now, you know, for my last show this season, at the end of my eighth season, I'm doing the world premiere of The Flamingo Kid, which is an exquisite musical by Scott Frankel, who wrote Grey Gardens, and Robert Friedman, who wrote Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece. And then after that, I'm developing three more musicals. And there's something about it these days, especially. There's something about musicals. It unites people at a time when not much does, and that's a beautiful thing.
I think also, first of all, I grew up around musicals. My father wrote the book for a Broadway musical. I've always loved musicals. But, you know, you could talk, people say with no sense that they are being a Philistine or anything like that, they say, I don't like musicals. I don't like musicals.
Well, they are Philistines if they say it.
Well, yeah.
If you've heard a Cole Porter lyric, a Lorenz Hart,
right.
You know, or Sondheim. You can't dismiss an art form. Then you are a Philistine.
But I think there's, for a long time, there's been this idea, well, I don't like it because people break into song and there's something artificial about that. And I wonder, I mean, you know, it's hard to get through a conversation like this without saying the name Hamilton. But Hamilton, partly because, of course, it is a sung through musical. So you don't really go from speech to song that much. But I wonder whether Hamilton is a little bit of a cure for that disease, too. There's a lot of people who say they don't like musicals, but they'll do anything to get a ticket to Hamilton.
Absolutely. I think it's been galvanizing, and I think it's been just great for the field in general. It's been absolutely great for the whole field. It's a burgeoning art form, and it creates stresses on other shows, you know. Hamilton is, among other things, incredibly, incredibly financially successful, and it creates expectations maybe for other shows. And as you know, only 25% of the shows on Broadway ever recoup. So you know, it's actually very, very hard to do a successful piece of populist entertainment like Hamilton. It's one of the hardest and most, you know, it's very tricky. Chorus Line, you know, Rent.
But I think
musicals.
If you watch around the theater district right now, you've got The Prom. You've got people waiting in line for a Waitress.
Yeah, it's doing well.
And
musicals.
Dear Evan Hansen.
Yeah.
I think the one thing that happened was people sort of said, okay, I just saw Hamilton. What else is there? There's got to be something else, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that part's been good anyway.
Yeah.
I was saying to you before we went on the air, I just went and saw Merrily We Roll Along, which is this incredibly problem-plagued Sondheim musical that closed after 16 performances the first time they did it. And the Fiasco Theater, who I think are unbelievably innovative and interesting, have, I think, found a way to tell this story. Have you done Sondheim before? Have you directed Sondheim?
I've just done Little Night Music once.
Is that somewhere in your bucket list now or something?
Others, not so much.
Yeah.
Not so much.
Well, there's also, I think, a sense of part of the American theater narrative is, let's put on a show.
Sure.
Let's put on a musical, right?
And right now, what I'm most thrilled about, what I want to see is Be More Chill.
Yeah.
Because it's a musical. It's become a hit because of young people. They have turned it into a hit. The press didn't really understand it. That doesn't matter. It's this young fan base, and they have a way of communicating with each other. I saw a lot of this happen with Anastasia. They created a culture around our show. They're definitely creating it around Be More Chill, and it's fascinating. You know, I can't wait to see it.
Yeah. I think also, for you as a director, I would assume, and I have a tiny little niggling experience with this on my own, there's something about standing at the back of the theater, and I'm sure it's great, you know, standing at the back of the theater on a night when the engagement party, which is up right now and is not a musical, is really clicking. But something about a musical that's really clicking, you know, and the audience is just, you know, riding the rhythms and melodies of the songs, it's got to be a pretty ecstatic feeling. When Gentleman's Guide was up and you could just tell people were going nuts for it. I mean, that must feel good.
There's nothing like it.
Yeah.
It's really great. It's really, and it could almost be dangerously addictive. I don't want to turn it into a drug, so I'm trying to be very selective about the projects I pursue.
Let's talk a little bit about Shakespeare. I think that's, you know, still maybe your biggest signature is your interpretation of Shakespeare. Maybe you don't feel that way.
I do, and I feel like looking back on it, the most satisfying experience at Hartford Stage was Hamlet with Zach Appleman. That was deeply satisfying in every way. And it's, you know, there are a number of Shakespeare plays I would like to do them again because I think I could do them better. And I think, you know, for that play, I don't see the reason to do it again. I really said what I wanted to say with that production. And I had great partners, Kate Forbes and Zach and the whole company.
It's funny because I'm not just saying this. If you had asked me what your best Shakespeare was, that was going to be my answer too. And I think the reason for that is, I mean, Hamlet has done so much. Everybody's got some issue with it or some new take on it. It seemed to me that your approach to Hamlet was, this is a ripping good yarn. This is like a very, very good story, you know? Let's just tell this story and let that be what the play is. And I'd seen a bunch of productions of Hamlet right around the same time, and I didn't think anybody else did it the way you did.
Well, for me, also, he's a friend, James Shapiro, who wrote 1599, A Year in the Life of Shakespeare. So through talking to him and reading that book, I was able to look at it. What was this to Shakespeare in the year that he wrote it? So that was the lens I looked at it through.
So you said there are some ones you want to try again. Are you willing to say what those are?
Oh, God. You know, the one that I did twice and for the chemistry ones, the ones with "and" in the title, are really hard. And my favorite poetry in all of Shakespeare, and I think I could do better for a variety of reasons, it didn't quite line up, but it's my favorite Shakespeare text, and my favorite poetry is all Antony and Cleopatra.
Huh.
In Act 5, what he writes for her, as far as poetic imagination, is unparalleled. I think that is the most beautiful poetry in all of Shakespeare.
Interesting. You know? So the ones with "and" in the title, I like that.
Yeah, it's hard.
Idea.
The chemistry ones are really hard.
But not "for" in the title. I was thinking about "Measure for Measure."
I haven't done it yet.
I would think you would have an interesting approach on that.
But I did think that I wanted to direct every single Shakespeare play, and I've done a number of them. I've done Winter's Tale 4 times. But now, working with living authors, especially composers and lyricists, is deeply satisfying. So now, actually, that's my main interest.
So as we're talking, the engagement party is up and running. Mm-hmm. So are you working with the Flamingo Kid people on an intimate basis at this point? Or is it still kind of?
I just read the beautiful new draft. And you were asking me about my life after Hartford Stage. You know, I have a house in Manchester on a quiet street.
Right.
It's a haven for artists. So the two authors came in, and it was a beautiful day in Connecticut. And we have 3 guest rooms, and it's great when people come over. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be around,
and
I like Max's Downtown and V's, you know, and I like Bin 228. I like Hartford very, very much. So I'm just not, you know, I plan to be a subscriber. I plan to support the arts institutions. I'm just not going to.
Is that going to be weird?
I'm going to pass on the hardest parts to Melia. No, not at all.
You don't
not
think that? I'll find it weird if I'm sitting there some night and you're in the next row.
I'm sure you'll get used to it. But,
I guess so. I mean, I think that's great, first of all.
I grew up, we moved so much, you know. This is the longest I've been anywhere, is Hartford. It's a tribute to the city, and I still want to be around. So, but you know, it's time to look at life in a slightly different way.
Yeah. Well, let me just go back. I don't mean to pry into what's going on in that Manchester crucible of musicals, but I've been lately kind of interested in what kinds of conversations a director has with the creative team and at what point. So here they are. They may not have written all the songs yet, or they may wind up, you know, as you get into this process, needing to write another song or what. I don't know. What's going on with you guys right now? I mean, is this a finished work that you're going to direct, or is this a work that is being born with you as part of the delivery team?
Well, for example, with The Flamingo Kid,
it's
in an exquisite shape, and everything can be improved. So the day after we opened the engagement party, I was exhausted. But I couldn't rest. We had to work on The Flamingo Kid. And by the end of it, I was just falling asleep on the floor. I was rolling around on the carpet. And then out of the stupor, I woke up. And out of some dream state, I was like, here's what the ending needs. And I was like, and we talked about the last verse for the leading character and the lens through which we were looking at what was still missing. So wonderful things can also happen out of sheer exhaustion and delirium. Like, you know, often that's the best.
Yeah, although we don't necessarily recommend that as a course of action in life.
Okay, I'll tell you this. For legal reasons, with Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, we had to change one of the numbers. This is the best moment I've ever had working with living composers, writers. But I love the tune, but we had to change the context of one of the murders. And I was listening to the tune, and it made me think of a skating waltz. And in rehearsal, I told Jefferson Mays, I was like, start skating, Torval and Dean. And we started to do this mad ice skating routine. And then at lunch, Robert and Stephen sat down, and they're passing a napkin across the table. And by the end of lunch, they came up with, as I'm cutting, I'm contemplating, and the truth is it's a tad exhilarating. With the rhythm of a violinist, I'll be cutting where I think the ice is thinnest. That's brilliant. That's when you feel really good. If you get 2 verses that brilliant, that's a great day for a director.
As a director in these situations, when you're birthing these musicals that haven't been performed yet, and you're, as you say, going to be doing a lot of it, I don't know, there are all these legends of, well, I mean, just go back to Prince and Sondheim for a second of, you know, they're doing Company and Sondheim has written this incredibly dark song and Prince says, no, throw that one out. I think that was Happily Ever After. And then he writes Marry Me a Little, which is a little less dark for the last song. And Prince goes, Nah, I don't think so. And that's how we get to being alive. Is that something, I mean, it seems to be have to have a lot of confidence to say to Stephen Sondheim, nah, we're not going to use that song. Do you have that kind of confidence with the songwriter?
Well, I haven't worked with him
in the musical. Yes.
But, you know, in Gentleman's Guide, there was a number that I think we went through a dozen numbers. Mm. And I had to say, oh, my God, it's still not there. It's still not there. Mm. It's still not there. And then finally, there was a number. And it's really hard. Mm. It's really, really hard. With Lynn Ahrens, who is, I think, Dorothy Fields of our time and wildly underestimated, with her, it was the opposite. We had to tell her. I was like, no, we're not cutting that song. It's beautiful. It's exquisite. The audience will love it. So, because she always wants to cut even her best work.
Yeah.
So it's very flattering because we're like, no, we're keeping that.
Right. It's creative people are odd that way, I think.
Yeah.
And I've seen that more than once. I interviewed Kander and Ebb. They were working down at Goodspeed. And I asked them the same question, that same kind of question. And, you know, what happens when a director or somebody says, you need a new song and you think you're all done? And they said, well, that we're incredibly happy, actually, when that happens. There's nothing we like better than going into a room and writing a song. So if you're telling us to go do that, we don't regard it as extra homework.
That's a beautiful way to look at it. Somebody's asking you to write another song.
Yeah. One more question about all this. In what way are you musical? In other words, do you sing? Do you play an instrument? Like, how do you, are you just a fan? How do you do the musical part of music?
You would not want to hear me sing at all, but my timing is absolutely perfect. So I eternalize every timing, and I read music. I rarely have to look at the score so that every rhythm is inside of me, you know, and I never forget it. So it's great. And even with operas, you know, like I have I know exactly the timings. I'm always on top of it.
Right. Well, the way you did the ice skating thing was pretty impressive.
Yeah. But you know, what's interesting is... it's rubbed off, actually, and I don't talk about it much, but having worked on so many operas and musicals, I've started writing one of my own, and that's actually mostly what I'm focused on secretly.
Yeah.
I've been working on something for 2 years, and that's what's obsessing me 24/7, so that's what's keeping me up at night. So.
You realize you just became slightly less secret just now.
I know. Yeah. Well, you know, it's the exit interview. What the heck?
Right. Yeah. And good for you, I say.
Yeah.
So you're writing the book?
Writing the book and the lyrics.
Wow. Yeah. I have had that experience. It's lots of fun. You know?
Well, you know, it's something I can do on my own. Everything else from the moment I wake up, it's collaboration. It's working with many artists, huge staff. But sometimes I really love the lonely hours. I love working on something on my own.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the amazing thing about theater, right? You can do it alone for a little while.
Yeah.
But pretty soon.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that can be quite thrilling, too, I think, when you think you got something on a page and it's a certain way and then other people show up.
And, you know, I don't know of a director who's been as blessed. I've directed 100 productions, classics, revivals, new works.
Mm.
It's great. Nevertheless, there are things inside of me that I want to say that I can't say through other people's work.
Mm.
So I think it's a natural outgrowth that I would want to do it on my own.
We're going to take a quick break here. It's always exciting to me to talk to somebody I already know, but get him to show a whole different side of himself. And if this is the kind of conversation that you enjoy, when these people come on and ask you to support this show, do it right now because we'll get credit, which means we'll do more.
Hey, it's Kyone Wolf here with Betsy Kaplan taking a second out of your podcast. I know you thought you were totally off the hook from listening to the live fundraising, but we just want to take a second to say thanks for tuning in. And also, please help us keep this coming into your podcast feed. The number to call to be a member or renew your membership is 1-800-584-2788 or WNPR.org/donate.
And you have lots of advantages listening to the show on podcast because we're only going to speak to you for about 20 seconds, maybe 50 seconds, unlike 5 minutes. So reward us with the fact that we're speaking to you less time. We're taking less time out of your enjoyment of this great show that you're listening to. Give us some support to keep these shows going, no matter how you listen to them. 1-800-584-2788 or go online at WNPR.org.
We're back with Darko Trejnik. He is finishing his run, his exalted run at the Harvard Stage Company. It began in 2011. It's going to end at the end of the 2019 season. I think maybe since I just said something about years, let's talk about, another thing that happened while you were artistic director, and having to make a whole bunch of philosophical choices about what got on stage was America just took a very strange turn in 2015 and 2016. It tinctured, I think, your time and a lot of the choices you made. Just to say a little bit about that.
Well, honestly, I could survive so much personal grief and not skip a beat. The election happened, and for the first time, I didn't know how to go on.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to get back into rehearsal. I didn't know what to do. Mm. And that night, I stayed up all night. The next morning, I thought about it, and I actually extended my time at Hartford Stage by a year because I was only going to stay for 7 years. But I realized there was a lot of trepidation, and I thought that it would be maybe good for the company and for me not to go through so many changes. So I gave it another year, and I'm really glad I did because we're doing some beautiful shows. But at the end of the day, that has also influenced my decision because I find that in the long run, often I'm just really depressed and I'm demoralized and angry. These are not the best things for creativity. So whether people agree with my political views or not, if they've enjoyed my art, they might just want to think about the fact that I'm not the only one. There are artists, artistic directors across the country going through that.
And I wonder if those things are so bad for creativity. I don't know. I think good and bad might be the wrong terms. Different.
I can find glory in rehearsals. I can find fantastic moments in rehearsal. That has always been the place where I'm happiest. I'm never happier than when I'm rehearsing. Mm. Even in front of the audience, it's a little bit different. But in rehearsal, I find that, like, you know, what has happened has not affected me. But the other aspects are much harder. And I find that right now there may be people who can willing to do it and who can do it better. But I still, it was staggering and demoralizing. And the next show that I was doing was a farce, comedy of errors. And I just didn't want to laugh.
Yeah.
You know, it was really, really hard. That was the hardest it's ever been.
My staff will tell you, I got physically sick in a way that I just doesn't really happen to me.
Yeah.
And I couldn't, physically sick and I couldn't get better.
Eventually I had to go and for the first time since my 20s, I went on antidepressants and I was like, I just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't figure out a way how to, and you know, as I've said, I don't know what it is to take a sick day. I've never taken one in my theater career.
Yeah.
You know, but this was... At times, I felt like a zombie. I was so upset.
So a production like the Bernard Shaw's Heartbreak House is,
was a response.
It was a response. So it got pretty explicit. Couldn't have gotten much more visually explicit. There was a character who very strongly resembled Trump. But do you think it sort of seeps into just about everything? I mean, let's get specific about the engagement party.
You know what? It doesn't.
Yeah.
It doesn't. It can't.
Yeah.
It can't actually because it would be shoehorning art and art deserves better.
Right. I don't say shoehorn.
More
osmosis.
I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does probably.
So let's take the engagement party. This is a new play that you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a lot of the characters are one percenters. They might even be half of 1% percenters or something. They're extremely wealthy people. There is an ethical dilemma that pops up. It's an ethical and existential dilemma that has to do with money and trust and suspicion and doubt and resentment. And it is taking place in a very expensive New York City locale. I don't know how you would keep the politics of 2019 out of that play. They're just going to get in there even if you try to waterproof it.
You know what was interesting? It didn't, for me, have as much to do with the man in the White House. In that instance, it actually, I remembered the play because of the Me Too movement. It has a connection to that. So I remembered and it struck me that it might be very, very resonant right now for that reason. And I feel like, you know, the thing about the 1.5 percenters in the play, you know, what's curious to me is part of my work as an artistic director, actors, you know, don't always like when I say this, I've gotten into big fights, but art in this country where we don't have government support, a lot of it, you know, it survives through the goodness, through the vision of people who are in the 1%.
Yes.
So I don't have any simplistic view of wealth, you know, but in this particular play, I think the compromises that the characters at the center of the play make and the damage that they do in order to belong to that 0.5%. It's a very specific story.
Yeah, it is a very specific story. So one of the things that I saw it last night, so it's fresh in my mind. One of the things that I was wondering, I've never directed a play, This is a play. There's something a little claustrophobic about this. I mean, you're essentially, you know, in several different rooms of one house while a party is taking place, and an awful lot of emotion and tension, some of it repressed and finally being let out, some of it, you know.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, does it become a problem in the cast at all? I mean, they're inhabiting these characters and
no, this was so much fun.
Really?
Oh, my God, it was fun. And you know what? Like, no playwright that I've met is like Samuel Baum, because what he does is he keeps cutting and paring things back. Mm-hmm. And anything that an actor can suggest with one line, with a short line, he keeps cutting and cutting so that it's a wonderful challenge. It's like a crossword for actors, because you have to nail an emotion, nail the meaning in half a beat, you know, and then he moves on. And so he actually kept reducing it because he trusts the actors, you know, in their ability to suggest what's going on under the surface of the story. It was an extraordinary experience. And what was really fun about it is, you know, that like if a character is picking up a towel from the floor, it may look casual. It's a completely deliberate move. When dishes are being handed off, when drinks are passed, it's time to the syllables. Mm-hmm. So, because it's a play that even when it's casual in the beginning, things are laid out that are going to add up to something later. So it was an extraordinary technical exercise, and that's what attracted me to it in the first place.
Well, so that's you, though. I mean, not everybody would have done that, probably. There'll be somebody else who will do that play and not time the rhythms out that way. That's you, right?
But fortunately, it's exactly as Sam sees it, you know. So it was a great collaboration because, and with the actors, when they recognized what the challenge was, that the most casual moments are adding up to things that are going to bite the characters in the ass later. That was wonderful. It was sheer joy, actually, in the room. It didn't get too heavy-handed.
So, you know, I've been going to theater all my life. I've been going to Hartford Theater all my life and New Haven Theater all my life. But no matter where you go to theater, I mean, people might know, probably do know the name of the artistic director if they're regular theater goers at a regional theater or anything like that. They might know some other things. I think it's a little unusual for theater goers to know a set designer quite the way Alexander Dodge has been here. So this, I mean, the engagement party last night.
Gentleman's Guide, Anastasia, many productions.
Yeah.
12th Night, that crazy maze for 12th Night.
The 12th Night in the Maze was unbelievable. And people almost gasp sometimes when they see what's happening. So first of all, maybe you can say a little bit about this. You're no stranger to set design yourself anyway, and part of your particular signature is a very visual signature. From the moment you got here and did The Tempest with all that hanging tapestry or hanging, whatever you would call that, you had a very specific idea.
Yeah, that was Alexander's design.
Yeah.
The Tempest,
But you also, I think there's a reason that you and he are working together. So maybe you can say a little bit about what set and artistic design mean to you.
What's interesting, speaking through the lens of, you know, the engagement party, for example, I find it so curious and I'm so proud of it that, you know, the press, like in the Hartford Courant, they talk about the luxurious set. There's an implication that we spend a ton of money.
Yeah.
We don't. Everything costs $20,000. It's the ingenuity and the illusion.
Yeah.
And it's Alexander's imagination. It's her shops. It's everybody who staffs Hartford Stage. It's the extraordinary invention. You know, we create this illusion of Park Avenue penthouse apartment. We really can't afford it. Yeah. You know, so and with Alexander, he has a gift of outrage. It's a gift. He's not afraid to be bold. And the thing, you know, he is the nicest man, and he's one of the most modest people I know, so he will probably kill me for saying this, but I think, you know, he was born with fine design in his genes. He's a member of the Dodge family. Mm. His father worked with Frank Lloyd Wright. Mm. He grew up in Taliesin, you know. So I think in addition to his extraordinary sensibility and training, you know, it's a part of him and it's something to celebrate and be proud of. I adore what he does.
You know, I feel like we've gotten a little spoiled here in Hartford. I was also recently, I saw The Ferryman on Broadway, and it's obviously the, you know, sweetheart play of Broadway at the moment. It's, you know, it's kind of the it play. And it has a terrific set, but they have to, it's a three-hour play, which they have to break at the first hour. And 1 hour into it, they have to do their big break, their 15-minute intermission, because they have to reset. Not dramatically, but they have to reset, and then they have like another two or three-minute break closer to the end, which is a crazy way to divide up a show. And I was sitting there going, oh, Alexander Dodge would have figured out how to do this. I mean, the whole reset would have happened, you know, just with one Well, I don't know. With
well, I think
some,
it's both of us working together.
Yeah.
You know what? I've never, out of the 100 shows that I've done, mm-hmm. I've never had a blackout. For some reason, it scares me. Mm-hmm. It's like a defeat. I'm terrified of an empty stage.
Yeah.
And I'm terrified of blackouts. So transitions. And, you know, if we don't do those, we kind of, it's almost like saying that theater is inferior to television and film, which it shouldn't be. So the magic of theatrical transformation is something that I try and practice religiously with my designers.
That's a great place for us to break, although I want to hold that thought. Let's take a break. We're talking to Darko Trejnik. We'll do that. We'll come back and we'll finish our conversation. Back with Darko Trejnik. He is living out his last few months as artistic director of Hartford Stage. So something you said right before the break made me think. You know, you said you don't like blackouts and you don't like the idea. Anybody thinking that theater is, you know, any less vivid or able to do what it needs to do than television or film. And I was watching the play last night, The Engagement Party. I knew I was going to be talking to you. And I was trying to think a little bit about that question, too. It's like, why do we go to theater? You know, why are we going to theater? We obviously can stay home and watch Netflix and there'll be something pretty cool on, you know. Yeah. So why are we? And I think part of it is, well, why do you think that? Well, who cares what I think? Why do you think that?
Because every once in a while, there are those moments where there's a galvanizing performance on stage.
Mm-hmm.
There are moments that are unforgettable. And the fact that we're there together with each other is what matters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what really matters. And there are people we get to celebrate. They become our heroes,
mm-hmm.
you know. Sorry to talk about it again, but the best way I can put it is I'm not a parent, but I feel like a dad when I watch Cristy Altomar, you know, sing Anastasia. And I wasn't sure that the role quite made sense because between the emotional fragility of the text and the power that's required in the vocals that anybody, I was just hoping that somebody would come through the door. And she did, Cristy. And I felt everybody behind the table leaning in and celebrating. And then she creates that sensation on Broadway every night. And so, you know, Jefferson Mays in Gentleman's Guide, a number of the people, sometimes it is conceptual. I know that people talk about the last moment in Hamlet with a horse rising through the trap and the father picking up the son in his arms. And so there are moments, you know, that I try and create, you know, what you hope is that you'll give somebody a memory that they'll think about till their dying day.
Yeah, I mean,
that doesn't happen all the time, but needless to say.
That would be a lot to ask.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways also, I mean, the obvious things are also the true things, that ultimately if you're sitting there watching The Engagement Party, you're as close to being there, you're only a few feet away from what's happening, which can never happen in television or movie. You have the exact same existential status. You have the same organs know, and skin as the people on stage. So that it can only happen there. And I think the other thing is, one of the things that I've thought about for, I don't know, 20 years, since my son was little, was the importance of seeing something where not everything can happen exactly the right way. You know, in other words, everything that isn't live can be fixed in post, as they say. Theater can't be fixed in post. And I don't know if you wanted to say something about that, but to me,
well,
that's important.
I certainly hope that in post you'll fix my interview. I'm hoping that you're going to make me sound much more articulate than I am right now.
No, I'm not.
Because some of these sentences are coming out very badly.
I'm hoping
in post you're going to fix me.
I would tell you if you sucked.
Thanks.
And you're not sucking. So.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. No, there it is. And, you know, sometimes people glorify the accident. I'm not particularly fond of them. But with something like The Engagement Party, it's a high wire act. What's happening backstage and on stage, you know, even the things that are meant to look casual, you know, I have to hold Josh or whoever is next to me when certain moments are approaching.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Because it's so nerve-wracking. Maybe that's why I can't be an artistic director much longer. It's stressful. But then, you know, like with this particular play, what's amazing is that the audiences are talking back. Mm-hmm. A few nights ago, there was somebody at the moment of the big reveal, somebody was like, oh, that's so nasty, you know, and you know, people are actually talking back to this play, and it's wonderful to when it feels that alive.
Right. Well, also, yeah. I mean, yeah. And I know what you're talking about from your point of view about worrying.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, for us in the audience, the fact that there, I mean, for example, a few nights ago, I am told, the house lights came on during.
Yeah, that was not fun. I'm glad I wasn't there.
You weren't there. But, you know, I mean, the people who were there told me about how the actors worked with that. I was at Kiss Me Kate when some kind of fire alarm went off and we all went out on the street and had to wait out on Church Street and then walk back in.
See, you know, Every time something like that happens, it cuts a week off my life. So it just stresses me out.
Yeah, but I mean,
that's just me.
Yeah, but I mean, in fact, when we got back in, and I can't remember what the line is, but there was a line that picked up perfectly from the fact that we had just been interrupted and sent out into the street. And for the audience, you're like, that's not going to happen watching Netflix. You're not going to have that kind of experience, that kind of memory. I used to take my kid to watch stuff like The Flying Karamazov Brothers because they might drop their juggling clubs sometimes.
Absolutely.
Which won't happen on the edited TV thing. And to me, that's super important.
It is. You know, and I have to say I prefer it when it goes into the other direction.
Of course.
You know, you have those nights in opera, you know, and you have those nights when you go like, I keep saying, you know, that stage acting, that the bottom has to be really high eight times a week.
Yeah.
That eight times a week, the quality has to be very, very high. But then when you get those exceptional nights on top of it, well, that's extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When things really, really ignite and soar, that's, and you live for that.
Yeah. Right. No, I mean, I think if we had our friend Carolyn Kwan here in the room, she would say the same thing, that you can get the orchestra to play some Bernstein piece really well for two or three nights, and then have them play it in this other way, right?
Yeah.
That is just, you know, you wouldn't even know how to ask them to play it that way, but they just did.
For those of us who work in this country, I keep repeating this, but I'm proud of what we achieve with limited amount of time because we don't have the luxury of European state-funded budgets, you know. And so this American way of creating art, you know, I learned my craft at the Williamstown Theater Festival. 18 days of rehearsal, 3 days of tech and two previews and you're on. Boom. Right. And so I'm proud of that, you know. And as I'm getting older, I don't want to do that anymore. I need another week. I need a week of tech. I need a week of previews. I just can't sustain it. I'm not that young anymore. But I think
people don't realize that
American way of doing art, that we're asked to do a lot on less time.
Maybe that needs to be the last thing that we talk about. I mean, you've alluded to it three times in the conversation.
Yeah.
I sense some real frustration with the American way of doing things.
Yes. Yeah. Well, sometimes, you know, all that I would say as I'm leaving Hartford Stage as an artistic director, I'm so grateful to our staff, board, artists who have graced our stage, most of all our audiences. Mm-hmm. I meet extraordinary, generous people every day in the state of Connecticut. It has really been deeply, deeply satisfying, and I just want to say a big thank you. And beyond that, what I will say is don't assume that the museum, that Athenaeum, that Hartford Stage, that the symphony, that we are all so secure.
Mm-hmm.
I've looked at some of the funding, you know, some of the changes, even from the local arts council. Mm-hmm. We get a fraction of what we used to. It's it makes me upset, you know, and as somebody who has worked very hard for this theater and this community, I just feel like also with corporate support, don't take us for granted because we contribute a lot. It's not just, you know, whether people come to the theater, but to the local economy, it means a lot, you know. And, you know, the stage company and that beautiful museum, it's a national treasure, you know. That's where I go for my breaks and everything. So the leading institutions don't take us for granted.
All right. That's, I think, a good place to end. But Darko Drezdnik, you will be missed, but apparently not that much. You will keep Manchester thriving as the Montmartre of Central Connecticut. And
I like, you know, my favorite places are V's, and I love Max's on the bar side. It's great, great liquor. So so you'll find me there.
We'll see you around. And
thank you.
I guess we'll see you probably in Section C, Row 3 on some nights, too.
Perfect.
All right. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
All right, that's the end of our show. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. To me, it was an eye-opener. I thought I knew Darko. He told me many new things about himself. Special thanks on this show to Jonathan McPants. He's the guy who produced the show and ran the board. The part of Bill Curry was played by Alfred Drake. We'll be back, but first, these nice people will ask you to support exactly this kind of endeavor. Now's a good time to do it, because we'll get credit.